The goal of sanctions was really to inflict a quick financial crisis that would be sort of the least cost outcome if that stopped the war right in the first weeks of it. This didn't happen.
When the war in Ukraine began, much of the world imposed sanctions on Russia. So how did Russia respond? And what is that teaching populists about policy in a crisis? Welcome to the fourth and last of our series of podcasts inspired by the research presented at the Winter Conference of Economic Policy, Papers on European and Global Issues. I'm Tim Phillips. Financial repression is how a government forces its citizens to hold debt that they wouldn't otherwise choose. Economists certainly don't recommend it, but in 2022, the Russian government used financial repression to prevent a currency crisis that Western sanctions have been designed to trigger. The implications of this reach far beyond Russia. High debt levels in many economies mean that governments face a short-term choice between unpopular fiscal reform or perhaps the quieter path of financial repression. Economics meet populism. As the political temptation to use these policies grows, I caught up with Oleg Ichkoki of Harvard University to ask what financial repression actually is, whether it successfully blunted the impact of sanctions on Russia, and what it may cost in the long run.
Russia basically introduced a whole range of financial repression tools domestically. It curbed the crisis.
Oleg, welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, we're talking about financial repression. Now, the era of globalization, I mean, that was driven by a consensus on the policy tools that you could and you could not use. Broadly, what did that consensus say?
There was this idea that free capital markets are good, right? And essentially, you do not intervene in capital markets. You open your economies to capital inflows, but this also means that capital outflows can happen. And you're not using tools to limit the capital mobility between countries. And that's sort of this idealistic view that was quite popular a few decades ago. But over the recent times, what policymakers have increasingly been promoting is that you need some interventions in these markets. And there are different tools that to different degree now are endorsed by economists as well and by international institutions such as International Monetary Fund. And those typically could involve some types of FX interventions, which are viewed more as benign tools of managing capital flows and shocks in the currency markets, let's say. And then there are kind of less benign interventions like capital controls. And perhaps the most crude type of intervention is financial repression that we study in this paper.
Which we're going to get to. So that Washington consensus, that hands-off idea, that's kind of gone now.
Pretty much.
How widespread has the use of these tools become?
Interestingly, they've been always used.
Uh-huh.
They were just in the past kind of discouraged by international institutions and economists. There was this broader view that you have to try to go to a more pure, more libertarian type of macroeconomic management. But policymakers have been doing it all along, right? Mm-hmm. And so what really has changed is the state of thinking. So we now understand more the conditions and the correct ways of using these tools. And then we also have stories of bad use of those tools. So if you're trying, for example, to sustain a fixed level of exchange rate and you're using different tools at the availability of the policymaker, but if the shocks have hit the economy, the fixed level of exchange rate might not be the right thing to try to target, right? And so this is viewed as bad practice oftentimes. This is something that leads to accumulation of imbalances and eventually can lead to a crisis. In contrast, if you use, for example, FX interventions to smooth the shocks, to smooth the transition in response to shocks, to reduce volatility in the market, that oftentimes is viewed as something that can be done. In particular, if the shocks result in volatility and drying up of intermediation in the financial market, central banks can step in and help the private market to do the intermediation. And that's viewed as a more benign type of intervention.
Now, you distinguish between benign interventions, looking at exchange rates or capital controls. As you say, they've become fairly common around the world. But you're looking at financial repression. What is financial repression?
So very broadly defined, financial repression is any type of intervention by the government that distorts the private financial decisions of agents domestically.
Uh-huh.
So the difference with capital controls, which mostly concerns the cross-border capital flows, this is about the domestic financial decisions. And historically, we've been thinking about financial repression more narrowly as sort of the government pushing government debt onto the domestic banking sector, forcing domestic banking sector to hold government debt despite low returns, despite the possibility of default in the future, crowding out the financial resources from private investments, right? And so this is how financial repression has been viewed traditionally. There are many examples of financial repression where the goal is not necessarily selling public debt to the banks,
uh-huh.
but sometimes it's distorting consumption savings decisions of the households, forcing them to consume less and perhaps save more. It could be also targeted to the currency market. In many countries, consumers want to save in foreign currency domestically. That's what we call dollarization. And oftentimes financial repression tries to discourage dollarization of the domestic economy. These are all types of financial repression. What's important is you have to sort of separate normal times, so countries under business as usual, from situations where there are like external forces like sanctions. It could have to do with like fragmentation in the financial market. And so financial repression plays very different roles sort of in normal times and under external stress. Our focus in particular was the use of financial repression when a country is under sanctions. And
yes,
this, we've seen a lot of that.
Most obvious example, Russia, 2022. How was financial repression used then?
Yeah, and so this is actually the most perhaps salient example in the data. It's quite important to separate it from ubiquitous use of financial repression when the country has a high levels of debt, and year after year, decade after decade, there is some financial repression of the banking sector happening. And that's been true in many countries, both advanced economies and developing countries. So now the case of Russia is very different. This is the country that started an aggressive war. And in response, the coalition of Western countries imposed very strict sanctions, right? It was a barrage of sanctions from financial to trade on all sorts of dimensions. And so the big question of the day was, is this sufficient to sort of inflict a financial crisis, a bank run, a currency crisis that would make continuing the war untenable? And so in response to the sanctions, Russia basically introduced a whole range of financial repression tools domestically. It curbed the crisis. It kind of turned the corner. The ruble, the Russian exchange rate, was depreciating very quickly, but these measures of financial repression stopped it and actually turned it around. And so the big question of the day is, was there something else that Western countries could have done, or financial repression can be always successful and stop in this type of crisis?
Specifically, what tools of financial repression did Russia use?
It was a whole range, and some of these things look like taxes. So for example, there was a tax on purchasing foreign currency. Some things look like regulation, that the exporters were regulated to sell their export foreign currency revenues back to the central bank. But some of the things were direct repression. Consumers, households would come to the bank to try to withdraw money from their accounts, and the bank would tell them that the government directed them not to release the funds. And so these are the more brute, crude measures of financial repression.
Now, whatever you think of the reasons why Russia was under sanctions, and whatever you think of financial repression, you're saying that this achieved their short-term goals?
Oh, absolutely. So the goal of sanctions was really to inflict a quick financial crisis that would be sort of the least cost outcome if that stopped the war right in the first weeks of it. This didn't happen. And in that sense, the sanctions didn't achieve their first goal. And so now when you think about financial repression, if you have an authoritarian government, can they use these measures always so that making this financial sanctions futile in a way, right?
Uh-huh.
And so the answer is, given the scale of sanctions, just imposing this financial repression measures, banning households from withdrawing cash from their bank accounts, was successful enough. Obviously, if this lasts for a long enough time and people cannot withdraw funds from their bank accounts, that would really create a big cost for the economy.
Mm-hmm.
What we didn't observe happening, because Russia was still exporting a lot, the foreign cash came quickly back to the country. So these measures of financial repression didn't need to stay in place for a long time. So they were imposed very swiftly, and then they were taken out a few weeks later, right? And so the real costs have not been realized. And the reason here is that Russia was still receiving loads of foreign cash from the exports. And that's really the part of the sanctions policies that was not effective.
Is it in your research, you model this, can we draw any conclusions about when financial repression is, well, good policy, effective policy?
Yes. So I think there is a fairly clear conclusion that in normal times, it's highly distortionary.
Uh-huh.
Governments have incentives to do it, but these are not the good incentives, right? And this happens when the government debt is too high, the fiscal costs are too high, fiscal capacity is limited. And instead of doing a fiscal reform, the government is doing these distortive measures of financial repression. And we've seen this around the world, and this is a bad use of financial repression. Then there are emergency situations when there is a financial crisis or a bank run happening. And then this is a completely fair game to use financial repression. Most countries would do it. And the whole question is, are you just buying your time to do the necessary reform? Or you plan to keep these measures in place for a long time? Keeping them in place for extended period of time is hugely distortionate.
That's what I was going to ask you. This is short-term emergency fixes.
Absolutely.
And generally speaking, when we're seeing them used now, are they being used as that short-term fix? Because it must be very tempting to keep them in place.
Yes, exactly. The good use of it is to commit to use it very temporarily, and this way encourage the reform or adjustment to happen. But as usually happens, the political economy of it, that once these measures are put in place, it's very hard to take them away, right? And that's the pitfall.
Do you have to make that commitment up front to say this is temporary?
Well, so this is the interesting thing. So usually once you have to recur to these measures, it's perhaps because the government has already lost much of its commitment.
Yeah.
And so whether the government promises to take these measures out quickly or trying to commit to it, well, perhaps there is not much trust in the government anyways. And so the important thing to keep in mind here that these are really emergency measures where most other types of interventions, the ones that perhaps rely on the reputation of the government and the promises of the government, have failed, right? And in that sense, it really becomes just discretionary equilibrium. Promises don't have a very high value under those circumstances.
We started off saying that financial repression was kind of like the big tool, the very difficult thing to justify. The way you're talking about it, it sounds like in today's current geoeconomic environment, there is a good argument for many countries to be using it.
Oh, absolutely. And it's coming back. So we've seen it used a lot more. So there was a period when, in fairness, the debt levels were low and there was less need, less interest in financial repression. But we're coming back to a situation with high debt levels around the world. What's peculiar about the situation is that emerging countries have more conservative policies. They accumulate in less debt than the rich countries. So the rich countries are now in a situation where the debt levels seem to be unsustainable in the long run.
Uh-huh.
And so what's peculiar about it, we've seen the return of financial repression in advanced economies, a rather unusual situation.
It is a rather unusual situation. Can you make me an agenda of which countries could justify it at the minute?
Well, the thing is that you can always justify it as an emergency measure, but there is really no justification for it as a long-term solution.
Uh-huh.
And so as we're discussing, exactly the concern here is that once we enter the era of financial repression, once it becomes ubiquitous, it really becomes a permanent part of the landscape of financial policies. And that's what you want to avoid. And so unless you bring the debt levels back down to more sustainable levels in the long run, I think it's fairly easy to predict that financial repression will be there. Now, what does it take to bring the debt levels back, right? It requires a fiscal reform. You either reduce government spending or you increase taxation. And neither of these are popular. So what the policymakers are left with is go with a path of least resistance of actually doing financial repression instead of doing the fiscal reform.
And that's exactly as a sort of populist political move.
Yes. And so US has been a country that has not been using financial repression for decades now.
No.
But given the debt levels, there is a good possibility that instead of seeing through proper tax reform, there would be actually increasing measures of financial repression. Oftentimes, it doesn't come as formal measures like taxes or regulation. It comes as implicit convincing that the government is doing with the banks for them to hold more debt even on the terms that are not exactly financially desirable for the banks, but they don't find the alternative possible in a given political environment. And so they keep holding the government debt. And we've been seeing that the foreigners are less interested now in the American government debt, and it's more and more held domestically. Financial repression can even amplify that, that most of the US government debt would be held domestically eventually.
As you say, the political consensus on financial repression has changed. Has the economic consensus of it, I mean, during Washington consensus times, no one would have been able to stand up at a seminar and talk about it. Has that changed now?
Economists still broadly view it as highly distortionary and undesirable. And so in that sense, in the academic discussion, I think it's very clear that financial repression is viewed as an undesirable policy to recur to frequently and persistently. Now, again, as we were saying, it's an easy solution for politicians. And so in that sense, it will be there whether we want it or not. It's just part of the current landscape. And unless there are major shifts in the fiscal positions of the countries, it's going to be there. I don't see it's becoming approved or encouraged going forward. We'll keep complaining about it, but it will keep coming back.
And if it just does become a policy that's used everywhere, what will not be done? What is the long-term bad outcome that we might see if there is too much financial repression?
Oh, so it's very clear. We'll be in an equilibrium with high levels of government debt, which are distortionary. They crowd out private investments. They result in distortions in the financial market where the return on government debt is low, whether because, you know, the interest rates are suppressed or whether there is a possibility of default. But financial repression rechannels the funds that would have gone to productive private investment towards the government debt that is unsustainable under market conditions. That's why exactly you have to use financial repression to force private agents to hold it, because you cannot have it as an equilibrium under undistorted market conditions, because the cost of funding for the government is too high then.
I don't think I like the sound of that, Will. Let's hope it doesn't occur. Oleg, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
The paper is Sanctions, Capital Outflows, and Financial Repression. The authors, Oleg Ichkoki and Dmitry Mukin. It is published in the current issue of Economic Policy, Papers on European and Global Issues. And that issue is titled, What's Next for Ukraine? For more on the Winter Conference and all the papers in this series, go to economic-policy.org. And if you haven't yet, follow Vox Talks Economics to listen to our three-part series on how Ukraine will rebuild after the war, also based on papers presented at this conference. We cover the investment it will need, the reconstruction of its cities, and the impact on jobs.
This was a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer was Megan Bieber. And the sound editor was Andrei Zargarian.